The following teaching is part 3 in a 20-part series by Dr. Ken Boa titled, Answering the Tough Questions About Life and God.
Just to give you a summary of where we've been the last 2 weeks. The first week, what we did is looked at postmodernism, and we looked basically at the issue, a growing concern that people have as to whether you can know anything at all, as to whether truth is really out there, is there any such thing as an objective form of truth, as to whether there is such a thing as an objective truth. We looked at the issue of an objective morality, that which is true, beautiful, and good. And we're arguing that although many philosophies would eliminate those things, nevertheless, we find that people live in ways in which they actually act as if things really are right and wrong, true and false, beautiful and ugly, and that the way in which they live their lives is one thing, and then indeed we also saw that any attempt to try to defend that mindset that all those things are basically social constructions are really self-defeating. It's like writing a sentence, and the sentence says, this sentence is incorrect. And as soon as you make that statement, then it's got to be true in order to be false, and if it's false, it's true, and it runs around in circles. And the problem is, I can't speak a sentence in English. Well, you've just done that. So you can see, again, that any kinds of efforts we make for that are really not coherent. One of the things I'm arguing in our time together is that the heart cannot rejoice in what the mind rejects. But that many times people don't even deal with these kinds of objections until they really consider issues that have to do with what we call worldviews, ways of seeing, ways of viewing the world. And very many times our worldviews are kind of cemented to our face. You know, they're like glasses locked in, and you can't take them off to see it from another perspective. So what we're trying to do here is to examine the implications of these principles. And last week, we looked at three basic worldviews. I said last week that the one option you have is that ultimate reality is material only. The second option you've got, and there are variations of that. Another option you've got is that ultimate reality is spiritual, transcendent, but not personal. The whole New Age movement is based upon that notion. The third option is that ultimate reality is personal. And I'm arguing here that that each of these views has profound implications. Tonight we're going to launch into the questions themselves, and the first one on your sheet, as you can see, has to do with the question of whether there really is a God in the first place. But the fundamental questions that we're going to be looking at really move from the general to the specific as we go from the big question about whether there really is a God at all. Then we can talk about the questions of miracles, the question about isn't religion just a psychological crutch for emotionally weak people. Those are broad based objections to religion in general. But then when we go further, we see that other objections have more to do with Christianity in particular. The objection that all kinds of variations in this question, isn't the Bible full of contradictions and errors or all the kinds of possible permutations in that? The problem of suffering and evil, how can a good God allow the innocent to suffer? Isn't it narrow? Isn't it bigoted? Isn't it intolerant to suppose that Jesus is really the only way, especially in a culture that values tolerance above truth as a moral virtue? And a follow-up of that question is those who've never heard. If he's the only way, then what about all the people, let's say in pre-Columbian South America, who've never heard the gospel? What about them? Are they all condemned then since they didn't hear about Christ? As we move on, then we look at problems of clarification concerning the gospel. Now we get much more specific. When a person begins to catch on to the implications, the radical implications of a message that claims to be offering a gift of eternal life on the basis of a gift, not of works, that raises a number of questions. What about people who are the sincere followers of other faiths? People who work hard? People who are sincere and pursuing these things? Are you saying that those people will not have a chance? Or if you say it's a question of faith, not of works, that just seems like it's too simple. That's just too easy. That doesn't wash. No one gets a free lunch. What does it mean to believe anyway? Isn't that a very subjective, relativistic term? And how can a person really have any assurance about the possibility? Isn't it arrogant to suppose or make the claim that a person that you can know that you would go to heaven? So those are the kinds of questions that surface and have surfaced for the last 2,000 years. it'll turn out that none of these questions are new. That is a good thing. Because if there aren't any coherent answers to these questions, then again, the issue is an unexamined faith is not worth believing, to do a variation on the Socratic axiom. The idea here is that you and I have been given intellects as well as emotions and wills, and that what does not satisfy the mind really then will not resonate well with the heart. Now, there are some people who frankly say, just believe and don't worry about all those things. But there are other people who won't find that very satisfying at all. Some people really want to think those issues through, and I was one of them. So as I remember coming to faith a month after graduating from college, I wrestled very hard with a number of these very issues because I was very much into a number of influences from Eastern philosophies and so forth. And I struggled and was going through a period of conscious worldview transition for a number of months. It was a painful, kind of an agonizing process as I was really sorting these things out and trying to discern, are these things really so, or is it an illusion? Am I deluding myself? Because who at the end of their journey want to come to the point where they saw that they were building their whole foundation on something that was sand and it had crumbled away? That would be a pretty unpleasant thing. So that for me, I wanted to think these things through. What good evidences are there that really support the faith? So as we think about these things, I've come to see a relationship between faith and reason before we get into the question of the existence of God. The intellectual side is very important. But at the end of the day, I'll be arguing that it's one thing, let's say, to believe in Jesus. It's another thing to believe that Jesus did these things, to believe that Christ is who he claimed to be. Some of you will believe that, some of you will not. But the issue is, even if a person believes that Jesus was who he claimed to be, that will not be really the same as true faith, because faith has to do with a more volitional aspect of trusting or entrusting oneself to this person. So that demonstration is needed on the belief that side. But a decision, the response, some kind of response is needed to decide whether I'm going to respond to his initiatives. He's always, you recall, before us. But still, do I respond to those initiatives or do I resist those initiatives? Demands evidence for, but on the side of belief as faith, it demands a commitment to a person. It's not merely just an intellectual trip now, but it's a more of a personal relationship. So that while belief that is necessary for faith, we'll be saying that belief in is necessary for salvation. That the belief that precedes faith, but the belief in follows reason. And so it's a reasonable faith. And again, we could unpack that some, which I'm not going to do. But basically, we're suggesting simply that the claims that Jesus makes were not done in a vacuum. These are issues that have been wrestled with over the years by intelligent people who really want to have a clarity of focus and understanding. And so what I thought we would do together then is to limit myself merely to two sessions max on each of these 12 questions, or we'll be on a train that'll never get off. So so if I went into the kind of depth that some of you might want us to go into, well, after 3 or 4 years of doing that, I might have 3 or 4 people in this auditorium, and that would be about the extent of it. So understand, this is simply an overview. It's just a brief treatment. All I intend to do tonight is to kind of walk you through the first part of this and then finish it up next week. And then we're going to go right on into the question about the miracles and so forth. What we'll do from time to time as well is to give you a time to interact with me by way of questions. So always be thinking about what questions you have and write them down if they come to mind. So let's take a look then at this first issue. Does God exist? You see that there are really only 3 basic options in front of us that we could consider. There is no God, or perhaps there's a God, or yes, there is a God. So the issue here, and then the question, if it's yes, what kind of God are we dealing with? Impersonal or personal? What do you mean by God? These days, especially, you have to define what you have in mind here, because you can't assume that there's going to be a uniformity to that. But the first viewpoint is simply the idea that God does not exist. A form of atheism or a form of agnosticism, I'm suggesting, would have to have all knowledge if we start with the no, the claim that God does not exist. It's helpful just to draw a circle to represent all knowledge. Now, I'd have to ask a person, if this represents all of knowledge, how big a circle would you draw within that circle to represent your knowledge? If that's all that can be known about the cosmos, the universe, and so forth, how big a circle would you draw? I think that even the most arrogant person, I doubt, would draw something much bigger than that to suggest that this is my knowledge here. I mean, if you really think about it, you'd have to be a colossal egotist to make this thing much bigger than that. We have basically a thimble full of knowledge, and there's an ocean of truth out there. Now, let's be honest, some people have a thimble full that would fit over some people's pinkies, and other people's thimble would be big enough for other people's thumbs, you see. But frankly, the guy with the thumb thimble has really little to boast about over the guy who has the little pinky thimble, because we're talking about an ocean out there, so relatively speaking, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. We're abysmally ignorant. And in fact, one of the things that always impresses me about people who know the most about their fields of inquiry is their awareness of how little they actually do know. The best scholars are the ones who are cognizant of their ignorance in their fields. The most dangerous person is a person who's just been educated just enough to be dangerous. You will know more after you graduated from college than any other time afterwards. So basically, after a while, you move to this position where you begin to realize, maybe I don't know as much as I thought. As a friend of mine put it, he says, the best thing I got out of a Harvard MBA program was the statement that was once made that a good education is moving from cocksure ignorance to thoughtful uncertainty. So what we have here is the realization that we know very little. In fact, what does science teaching us? If anything, just at the point when we think we've got it nailed down, then a whole new world opens up to us. A whole new world, for example, in the area of chaos theory that was not even known to exist 30 years ago. A whole new realm of subtlety that we did not even realize was there. Whole new worlds in molecular biology. In each of these fields and more, we discover how abysmally ignorant we previously were. We just thought we knew more, and we didn't. And so it actually ought to cause us to realize a sense of tentativeness and humility. In addition to that, we actually, as you know, draw on a very tiny component of our mental capacity. Nobody knows really what that figure would be. I've heard everything from 2% to 10%, probably not much more than that, in terms of your intellectual potential. But the fact is, we know very little. But even if a person had an IQ of 500, of course, what would it take to know what that's like? You'd need an IQ of 500 to imagine what it is like to have an IQ of 500. You can't do that. You don't have that category. But even if they did, they still would be very limited in their concepts. Imagine you go down to an area of the world, a tropic region, an equatorial region, and missionaries have had a really interesting time when they have tried to speak to natives in equatorial regions who have no access to media about ice. Think about that for a minute. Imagine the idea that ice, this liquid, gets so hard that actually you can cut it into cubes or different shapes, and it's cold. You can see that you'd laugh pretty hard about that. That if you've never seen ice, you have no category for the idea. You see my point? Imagine the humor that would produce. If their viewpoint about ice has very little to do with the reality about the existence of ice. And this is, I'm simply suggesting that humility would drive us at least to realize that we know a lot less than we supposed. So I'm suggesting here, you'd have to be omniscient to know that God does not exist. What I'm suggesting is, ironically, you'd have to know all things in order to know that God did not exist. You'd have to be God in order to know that God didn't exist, you see. How can you make such a direct statement that he does not exist? So I suggest that the wiser course of action then would be simply to say that we might not know that he exists. He may exist, he may not. There are hard forms and there are soft forms of agnosticism, but I believe that's really a more credible position than to make the claim that I know that he doesn't exist because of the implications that would provide. You'd have to virtually know all things to know that he does not exist. And in addition, yes, there are some arguments that are based particularly on the problem of evil and other things that are used to try to disprove his existence, but they actually all fall short for various reasons, as we'll see later on. What I try to do then is to mention that that's an option that's really not too livable. And then sometimes, though I don't always mention this, but just to throw this in, as I said last week, people don't really live as if there is no absolute. They behave as if there's meaning and value and purpose in the world. But I argue, really, that without God, there'd be no real basis for those things. By the way, to use an argument from the book of Romans, in Romans chapter 1, Romans makes the affirmation that all people really have an innate knowledge of God, whether they acknowledge it or not, is not the issue. That there is some realization in the human heart of some concept of an absolute being or some being behind it all. What's fascinating is even in animistic religions, there turns out to be a primal monotheism that underlies them. That they have a word for or a concept of some absolute or a remote being that they do not worship, too distant, too remote, but there seems to be a pretty universal awareness of some being of all, but normally that's too distant, too transcendent for them to be concerned about in any immediate sense. But I'm suggesting that this would comport well. When we think about this issue of meaning, for example, this first issue of meaning is an important one because the human heart cries out for meaning. And for all these things, when we think about the fact that the universe, as we know, is expanding, and ultimately left to itself, the universe will simply wear out. And eventually, there will not be enough useful energy to sustain even the simplest living system in any part of the universe. Given enough time, there will be no being around to remember our achievements, our poetry, our music. There will be nobody there to remember it in the endless cosmic night. Kind of a depressing thought. You can have short-term meaning, but without long-term meaning. The issue is, nothing ultimately is going to last. In fact, when we think of it this way, the whole human race, from the standpoint of cosmic time, is a mere blip on the map. It's just a little blip, and it's come, and it's gone, in terms of cosmic time. So I'm suggesting here that, from an ultimate standpoint, there may be short-term meanings, but in the context of long-term meaninglessness, in an utterly indifferent universe, utterly indifferent to human aspirations and desires. I suggest as well that the issue of value is an important issue because all of us really do have, as I said, some concepts of right and wrong. Every time you appeal to something as being a good action, and, for example, anything we criticize or condemn, how could you be so fill in the blank? You all use that phrase, haven't you? Unless you're not like most people. How could you be so selfish? How could you be so callous? We all have an idea that there is something wrong with torturing babies. I think we all have a pretty clear idea about that, about certain actions that are pretty universally agreed as being inhumane, cruel, tyrannical, and so forth. So I'm suggesting that we do have values. Whether we claim to have an absolute, we live in a moral universe, and we have values in our lives. But I'm suggesting here that if we're simply a product of an accidental combination of molecules in an impersonal universe, there'd be no real source for such values. You'd have to say all your values are merely culturally conditioned, that they're not absolute at all. They're just relative concepts that have no validity. By the way, C.S. Lewis wrote a wonderful book years ago called The Abolition of Man, in which he argued that there is really an amazing overlap in the various traditions, both in various cultures and over various periods of time, an amazing overlap in values, human values such as honesty or brotherhood or love and equality, and a generally an understanding against treachery or selfishness or hatred and prejudice. While there, at least there are these rules, there are these understandings that there are some things that we can agree are right and wrong, but there would be no basis for that in a universe without any absolute. Purpose is another issue, and I'm suggesting here that purpose really has to do with the idea that the universe, an impersonal universe, is more like Macbeth's tale told by an idiot. Life is like that, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. It's a great story, but it's idiotic, it's purposeless, it's meaningless. There's, what about my purpose for being on this planet? Again, if in the context of being maybe $3 worth of chemicals, as I recall, Sagan talks about that in his book and on the TV program. Remember Cosmos? Frankly, you're worth less than that in many ways. When we look at it that way, what defines our value? You see what I'm suggesting here? We come for a brief time and we're gone. And there's this tragic sense that we long for something more. That's what I talked about last week, about the problem of loneliness, insignificance, and meaninglessness. And people long for a sense of relationship, for a sense of significance. Remember, significance has to do with how long will it last? And if you really buy into the idea that death ends all, and that there's nothing beyond this, no consequences whatsoever, that would have profound logical implications for the way you ought to live your life in very different ways than you would live if you came to the conclusion that maybe that this life has something to do with the next and that we continue on. But the question is, we all long, I believe, for our lives to add up to something that will last. Remember we said before that we often hope that we'll last in the memories of our friends. So what do you hear so often when people speak about that? He will be remembered forever, won't he, by his friends, until they die. So it won't be a very long time, because after they're gone, there won't be anybody who will remember you. Best you've got is a name in a cemetery, and nobody will have any connection, nor will it do them any good, even if you did know who they were. I mean, let's be honest about this. The most any of us in this auditorium are likely to ever get is maybe a paragraph in some future edition of Encyclopedia Britannica, and I'm being generous. And let's just face it here. Even if you got a whole page about you, what good would that do you when you're gone? You see, you're just a name. There's no context. There's no real lasting value. So I'm suggesting, though, that in something in us, in our heart of hearts, longs for more purpose than that. Short-term purposes do not sustain a person who has eternity planted in their hearts. People, I think, long for more than that. So these, I think, have all bearing and relevance to our condition here, to this question. And by the way, again, I say that people live as if there is meaning. That's why they get out of bed in the morning. They live as if there is some kind of value somehow, and they live as if there's some kind of purpose. The point at which you lose those, the real question then is, why not commit suicide? Because that would be the biggest question. Why do you continue to live in this painful and absurd cosmos? I'm suggesting that if we say that God does not exist, it has profound implications for our thinking and our practice, but it's more consistent for a person to say that he may exist. I think the position of agnosticism would be a more consistent position, because a person's going to say, how would you know? And so the real issue that you have to ask is, well, what sort of proof would you need to have? I'm suggesting not 100% proof, but reasonable evidence, and that cause and effect reasoning can provide this evidence. We've all heard about theistic arguments for the existence of God, which frankly won't persuade people if they're not of a mind to be at all open or persuaded. It's been said that a man persuaded against his will is of the same opinion still. And you can. There are some people who can be very clever in persuasion and so forth, but then they'll spring back to right where they were before. The issue really has to do with moving to looking at the evidence per se, but what kind of evidence can one look at? What evidence would persuade us? And sometimes people are asking for a good bit too much. Some people would hope that we would have some kind of proof that's absolute, scientific proof that would establish it completely. It's like the Soviet cosmonaut. Remember Yuri Gagarin? And he went up and orbited the Earth. And when he came back, anyone recall what he said when he came back? I didn't see any God out there. You know, it'd be kind of scary if he did. It'd be like saying, I didn't see any Shakespeare in here. I opened up the pages of a Shakespearean play. I didn't see any Shakespeare in here. You see, you're looking for the poet behind the play. But he's not in the play in this way, you see. Although at one time he did enter the theater. Mm-hmm. And he entered the play and became an actor. The actual incarnation, the historical manifestation of God on this planet. Indeed, I'm aware of a couple of astronauts who actually became believers as a result of their experience in space. So that can also have a profound impact on you as well. When you see this little blue marble down there rising on the moon's surface there, and you realize that you're not here, that's where you were, you're here on the moon here, really a strange thing comes to being. you realize how incredibly awesome the cosmos really is and how incredibly small our little boat is as we move across the sea of space. And we realize, really, it's a sense of a very humbling thing. That's why I say a great exercise for anybody, and I strongly recommend you do this at least once a year, to maintain a perspective, keep you humble. On a relatively warm night, if you can, especially if you're in the country, lay flat on a hammock and look up, or in a deck chair or something, look up at the sky on a clear night, when you can, at a place where you can see the sky, so you have to go out of the city. Stare at it for a while, for a few minutes, a half an hour. And then you'll realize you're not looking up, are you? But you're looking down. In fact, there is no orientation of up or down. And you realize how absolutely awesome the cosmos is, and you're only seeing a tiny little local group of stars. And you realize that so much more goes beyond this. That's a rather humbling position. You see, otherwise we'll forget the fact that God is God and we're not. We'll easily forget that notion. And it's good for us to review that and to recall that and have a sense of perspective. So then what kind of proof would we need? And we have to ask, are we demanding scientific proof that God would be the end of some kind of a controlled experiment? I think that's not really what we're looking for. In fact, it turns out there are many excellent benefits of the scientific method. The scientific method can help us grasp certain things, and it can help us understand, for example, that you could say that smoking increases the probability of lung cancer, or that a molecule of water consists of two atoms of hydrogen and one of oxygen, or any number of things you can say, that the Earth is not the one that's around which the sun is going, but it's the other way around. Things like that you can figure out. But it doesn't deal with all forms of knowledge. What other forms of knowledge are there besides scientific knowledge? Can you think of some? There are other forms, and each of these forms of knowledge, has their own rules, has their own way of apprehension, and there are things that the scientific method will not be able to tell you about reality. Can you give me some examples? Historical knowledge, aesthetic, because aesthetic knowledge is going to be a very different thing than scientific knowledge. It has its own rules and so forth. You see that. What other forms? Personal. There's personal knowledge. So Pogliani talks about personal knowledge. He talks about a form of knowledge that is not apprehended by a scientific technique. The knowledge of persons, of others in relationship. There's another one that comes to my mind. I'm thinking about moral. And this is why you have this fundamental question that Oppenheimer struggled with after the bomb. After he participated in the formation of this massive instrument of destruction, and wrestled with that the rest of his life, because it's one thing to be able to create a powerful hydrogen bomb, it's another thing to say, was it a good thing to do? And the scientific method will not give you an answer to those questions. So each of these forms of knowledge has their own rules, their own modes of apprehension, and you can learn legitimate things in each of those spheres of inquiry, but at the point at which you want to reduce all knowledge to one of these, you're making a serious mistake. So I'm arguing here, then, that we have to realize that there are other ways of going about this that we need to ask. You know, you've all heard that silly story about the fellow who was caught in a flood, and he is on the roof of his house, and a rowboat comes. He cries out to God to deliver him, and a rowboat comes by, and he says, hop on. He says, no, I've asked God to deliver me, so he'll deliver me. Then, as it gets worse and worse, a helicopter comes by. We're going to lower this cable down here. Grab a hold of this thing. We'll pull you out. It says, no, God's going to deliver me. He drowns. And when he goes in before God, he says, God, why didn't you deliver me? He said, what did you do about the rowboat that I sent and the helicopter I sent? You see the point here. There comes a point when you can go so far that nothing will work. You see, your criterion of proof is more than you demand in any other field of inquiry. I mean, after all, what would it take to believe some of these things? That there be at 3 o'clock in the morning some kind of an angel coming to the end of your bed, or everything starts glowing red and there it is? You know, what would it take? This is why Jesus said this statement. If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, neither will they believe, even if someone rises from the dead. You remember that idea? Significantly, Jesus rose. Remember Lazarus from the dead, raised him from the dead, then after his own resurrection, and they still failed to believe. I suggest, by the way, it has much more to do than intellectual. There's also an apprehension to this level of truth. Unlike scientific or historical, in the issue of spiritual truth, there is a spiritual apprehension having to do with the will, with the volition. This is why I tell people, even if you're not sure about God's existence, the best thing you can do is openly say, God, if you're out there, I would like to know you. I mean, it's a prayer I believe that he would honor. Belief in God is not a leap in the dark, but it's a step into the light that there's a reasonable faith that's involved here. But a step it will be. But in any case, whatever position you embrace, there's a step. Because there's no position that's held, no worldview that's held without a measure of faith. Ultimately, you cannot demonstrate unequivocally to another person that this worldview is correct and this worldview is not, if they have differences here. Ultimately, you have to say, what is the evidence and what is the reasonable faith? What's the direction to take? There's a story about Bill. A fellow named Bill was involved in a serious motorcycle accident, and when he was brought to the hospital, he was on death's door, but they realized that if the guy was going to give it up and not struggle for his life, they wanted him to wake up and fight for his life and encourage him. And they asked him, he says, Bill, he's trying to... The guy was convinced he was dead. That was the problem. And so they had to convince him he was still alive. He says, I was killed in that accident. That's all there is to it. So they said, in their effort to kind of convince him, Bill, do you believe that dead men don't bleed? And he said, yeah, that's true. Dead men don't bleed. Well, if I were to cut your finger, and if your finger bleeds, then will you admit that you're not dead, but that you're alive? He says, yeah, sounds reasonable. So he takes a little scalpel and pricks the finger, and blood sure enough comes out. And Bill looks at the finger, and he says, well, son of a gun, dead men do bleed after all. At that point, no counterfactual is going to persuade the guy. You can see that you're so locked into this one deal that nothing's going to persuade you other than that. So a decision must be made, I think, upon sufficient evidence, not exhaustive evidence. When we think about cases in courts of law, that they're based, for example, on legal historical proof, not scientific proof. And in civil cases, the verdict's reached on the basis of a preponderance of the credible evidence. In criminal cases, it's when you're dealing with something that you're looking at beyond a reasonable doubt before reaching the verdict of guilty. It didn't say beyond a shadow of a doubt, but beyond a reasonable doubt. There's going to be always some measure, some level of ambiguity. And I'm going to have to ask the question, what evidence could be used? And I argue that cause and effect is the best approach because that's how we make most of the decisions we make. The biggest question is this. As Sartre put it, why is there something rather than nothing? Big question. Have you ever thought of this question? I'll let you think this question through. Why is there something rather than nothing? Now, if you really think and meditate and cogitate on that question long enough, it'll make your brain hurt. But it's a fundamental question. Why is there anything? Why am I asking this? Why do I have a mind that's asking this question? You see, how can that be? And you have this thing, how can there be even, if there is a God, where did he come from, is always the thing we ask, isn't it? The question that you sometimes think about. And so I'm arguing here that there are really only four possible answers to this question. Why is there something rather than nothing? We look at an if proposition. In the simplest terms, we're saying that if anything now exists, something must be eternal, or else something not eternal must have emerged from nothing. We're suggesting then that there are four options that come from that. Either something has to be eternal to account for things, or if that's not something eternal, then whatever that's not eternal, the universe itself, had to come from nowhere. You see? So you have to say, well, there could be the possibility that the universe is an illusion, that nothing exists, which some forms of Indian philosophy, Eastern philosophy, would take, that this universe is Maya. It is an illusion, and that it is really not out there at all. Those who say that the universe is eternal have to deal with the question of evidence that might be not fitting with that concept. Up until recently, that was the popular view, what was called the steady state view of cosmogony, and saying that the universe always existed pretty much as it currently is. That matter and energy and space and time always existed, but now there's good evidence to suppose otherwise. The other option is to say that the universe popped out of nowhere, You can say that. It's, to me, not very satisfactory, as we'll see in a moment. Or the fourth option is that the universe was caused by an eternal being. So as I see it, you have four options, and I'm going to just spend a minute on a couple of them, and we're going to finish this thing next week. I won't spend much at all on these four options, and I want to go into this next section next week. If we say, first of all, the universe is an illusion, it's a mighty consistent illusion. Have you noticed this yet? That it's really a self-defeating proposition, because you're saying that all the sensory data that I receive, I just claim that that's not really true. But, you know, even the person who says that nothing is true looks both ways before crossing the street. It's very interesting how they, again, day by day, they live one way, they may claim to hold to another view. If it's an illusion, it's really a very powerful and relentless and consistent fantasy that we have. So we're being bombarded by sensory data. And that's what I'm saying. Full-blown skepticism doesn't play in the everyday of life. Does that make sense to you there? Mm-hmm. You can make the claim, but let me see you walk through a day and act that way consistently. You're just an illusion. That produces great relationships, by the way. Talking to people, that you're just a figment of my imagination is really the stuff of which you have great relationships that are built. Better not say that to your spouse, that you're merely an illusion. No, I don't hear you. I just imagine that you're saying those things. I know you're not saying. Somehow we don't go with that notion. The notion that the universe is eternal is the most popular option, the most popular way out. And we argue there are three evidences or why this might not be true. One of the evidences, again, it has to do with an approach to cosmogony, the origin of the universe, that's a term it means, has to do with the Big Bang Theory. And while I want to stress something right now, my argument's not going to depend upon a particular scientific view of now, because let me promise you, 10 years later, it'll be modified radically from the view that's popularly held now. Don't know what it'll be, but you don't want to wed yourself to the scientific theories of the present, especially when it comes to cosmology, because it's a very volatile field indeed. But I'm suggesting, though, that there is, on the other hand, a growing consensus that the universe does not account for itself, that matter, energy, space, and time did not always exist, but that you can press it back far enough, and there appears to be a point at which the universe was squeezed into an incomprehensibly small form, like an atom, and that although that was blown out a period of years ago. Usually the estimates seem to be 13 to 15 billion years, but that estimate changes a great deal. And the point here being that if you press it back, because the discovery of the fact that with Edwin Hubble, the realization that the galaxies are actually expanding, that the universe is expanding, the galaxies are moving further and further away from one another, and then the realization that there is an omnidirectional background radiation that fits well with this whole concept, what you discovered then was a consistent way of seeing the universe that forced folks against their bias to admit that there seems to be some kind of beginning point. Now, some people will claim, well, what if the universe, though, it kind of blew out, and then it goes back in, gets sucked back in, and then it kind of blows out again? See, that could go on forever, right? Not exactly. Because with each successive Big Bang, there would be less and less energy in between. And so eventually, the whole thing would peter out long before an infinity of time went by. Furthermore, it's more likely that the big crunch would be the end of it all anyway. If it crunched in, it would be pretty bad, because it would crunch in so badly that there wouldn't be enough energy to blow itself out again, and so on and on. So the interesting issue here is that it does really appear, as best as we know at our present state of knowledge, that the universe does not account for itself but had a beginning point. We can press it back as far back as 10 to the minus 43rd seconds, from the time of the Big Bang, when all the four forces were squeezed together into one, and there's speculation about what that would be like and so forth. But the interesting thing is nobody asks about what happened, where did it come from before that. It's always an important question to ask that, because it does not account for itself. Another thing that we had was the abundance of hydrogen in the cosmos. And that will sound like an odd answer. But what's happening here is in the cores of stars, that the fusion is where the hydrogen atoms are being fused into helium, and it's a pretty one-directional process. That is to say that there is no significant formation of hydrogen in the universe, but there is the consistent movement from hydrogen to helium in the cores of stars. That's what drives the stars. That's what energizes them. Now, the interesting thing, if the universe were really very old, infinitely old, what would you suppose would happen? You'd expect to have very little hydrogen at this present time, and yet how comes it then that hydrogen consists of about 98% of the matter in the universe, you see? So you still have an enormous amount of hydrogen gas in the cosmos, which would indicate that this one-way process is not infinitely old. So it's another way of looking at it. I'll pick up next week and look at the third approach. But what I want to do here is just to suggest here that if the universe is an illusion, you can say it is, but if you can show the universe is not eternal, then the only other option you have, if it's not totally illusory, is that either it emerged from nothing or that it was created by an eternal being. Now, when we talk about the eternal being, we're going to suggest here that a necessary being is a being whose existence is such that it cannot not exist. Now, God is not a self-caused being, but an uncaused being. There's a big difference. He didn't cause himself, but there's an uncaused cause. The question, where did God come from? How many of you have raised this question or heard this question? You know, Mommy, where did God come from? Tough question. Kids ask very metaphysical questions at times. It would be like saying, who made the uncaused caused? Who caused the uncaused cause, you see? I'm suggesting there that you have a question. You're trying to push God back to time and space. Where did he come from? Who made him? You see, you're locking him back into time and into space. But understand, the biblical vision is that God transcends the boundaries of time and space in such a way that he is the eternal being, the eternal now, and so that matter and energy and time and space were part of his cosmos. In fact, we can see that time itself relates to matter around it, and that it is affected and it is shaped and it is warped by the continuum of gravity. So time can be affected by that. I'm suggesting that God alone is a being who's not bound to the cosmos, is not part of time, not part of space, but those are parts of his created order. That he always exists, and he speaks an order into being, and it has its origin, but he himself has no beginning. So he is an uncaused cause. So I'm going to be arguing then that that would be, for me, especially when we go back to here, the most reasonable of the four options. There are actually people who now believe number three. Up until this century, almost nobody would buy that idea. People have become so desperate that they have clung now to number three that it popped out of nothing. We'll mention that briefly next week. This stuff is a little bit harder, maybe for some of you than. But we're going to get on to some easier stuff later. We're going to be talking about the issue of miracles, talking about some of the other issues. But stick with me here. next week, I want to just tie some things together. Finish this up. Talk about the idea of why this eternal being would be personal, and then have a quick word about the implications of this for our lives, the nature of evolution. I won't spend much time on that. But just a little word about the idea of beings like you and me who are personal, who are complex, who have knowledge and thought. Tie those things together a little bit and then open it up for some interaction with you. And then we'll go on from there. I'll leave you with this thought. Okay, I'm going to leave you with two thoughts. I'm going to leave you with two thunks here. The first one is, why is there something rather than nothing? I'll let you work on that some more. And the second is, what on earth is energy? But let me and express it this way. All things can be reduced to energy, and nobody knows what it is. Now, that's rather interesting. You can't really say what it is. It's something very deep and very mysterious and very profound. But we throw terms like time around. I'd like to have anyone define what time is. There are terms that we banter and throw around. I'm telling you, we are surrounded by mystery, and we think we have all the answers. It's far more subtle and mysterious than we might at first suppose. According to the scriptures, that energy, God spoke it into being, and it was. And he chooses to withdraw his spirit, and it disappears. That energy ultimately, I think, comes from the Spirit of God, that God is the one who speaks it into being, orders it, and also calls it back. And the scriptures invite us to see that there will be a day when, in fact, that's the case, when he speaks it and withdraws it and then speaks out a new heavens and a new earth. The implications of that are pretty profound. But I'll close in a word of prayer. And next week we'll pick up from there. Father, we thank you that you have manifested yourself, that you really are there and that you're not silent. And I pray that we would think about these things and understand that you are the only one who always exists, and that you, for some reason that's inexplicable to us, have chosen to set your love upon us and desired that we be intimate with you, and that we find our identity and dignity and purpose and meaning and hope and destiny in the hands that you have, in fact, offered and extended to us. I pray that we would come to know that life. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org.